Chapter 13. Elizabeth Devereaux paid for her burger and my pie and coffee, which I thought was generous, so I left the tip, which made the waitress smile again. We stepped out to the sidewalk together and stood for a moment next to the old Caprice. The moon had gotten brighter. A thin layer of high cloud had moved away. There were stars out. I said, "Can I ask you another question?" Devereaux was immediately guarded. She said,
"About what?"
"Hair," I said. "Ours is supposed to conform to the shape of our heads. Tapered, they call it. Curving inward to a natural termination point at the base of the neck. What about yours?"
"I wore a buzz cut for 15 years, she said. "I started growing it out when I knew I was going to quit."
I looked at her in the moonlight and the spill from the diner window. I pictured her with a buzz cut. She must have looked sensational. I said, "Good to know. Thanks." She said,
"I had no chance right from the beginning. The regulation for women in the car required what they called a non-eccentric style. Your hair could touch your collar, but it couldn't fall below the bottom edge. You were allowed to pin it up, but then I couldn't get my hat on."
"Sacrifices," I said.
"It was worth it," she said. "I loved being a Marine."
"You still are," I said. "Once a Marine, always a Marine."
"Is that what your daddy said?"
"He never got the chance. He died in harness." She asked,
"Is your mom still alive?"
"She died a few years later."
"Mine died when I was in boot camp. Cancer."
"Really?" "Mine too. Cancer, I mean, not boot camp."
"I'm sorry."
"Not your fault," I said automatically. "She was in Paris."
"So was I. Paris Island, anyway. Did she emigrate?"
"She was French."
"Do you speak French?"
I said, "Un peu, mais doucement."
"What does that mean?"
"A little, and slowly." She nodded and put her hand on the Caprice's door. I took the hint and said, "Okay. Good night, Chief Devereaux. It was a pleasure meeting you." She just smiled. I turned left and walked down toward the hotel. I heard the big Chevy motor start up, and I heard the tires start to roll. And then the car passed me, going slow. And then it pulled a wide U-turn across the width of the street and stopped again, just ahead of me, facing me, at the curb, right next to the Toussaint's Hotel. I walked on and got there just as Devereaux opened her door and got out again. Naturally, I assumed she had something more to say to me, so I stopped walking and waited politely.
"I live here," she said. "Good night."
She had already gone upstairs before I got into the lobby. The old guy I had seen in the diner was behind the reception counter. He was open for business. I could tell he was disconcerted by my lack of luggage, but cash money is cash money, and he took $18 of mine, and in return he gave me the key to room 21. He told me it was on the second floor, at the front of the building, overlooking the street, which he said was quieter than the back, which made no sense at all until I remembered the railroad track. On the second floor, the staircase came up in the center of a long north-south corridor, which was uncarpeted and dimly lit by 4 mean and ungenerous bulbs. It had 8 doors off the back side and 9 off the street side. There was a slim bar of brighter yellow light showing through the crack under room 17's door, which was on the street side. Devereaux, presumably, getting ready for bed. My room was 4 doors further north. I unlocked it and went in and turned on the light and found the kind of still air and dusty chill that indicates long disuse. It was a rectangular space with a high ceiling and what would have been pleasant proportions, except that at some point in the last decade an attached bathroom had been shoehorned into one corner. The window was a pair of glazed doors that gave out on the iron balcony I had seen from the street. There was a bed and a chair and a dressing table, and on the floor there was a threadbare Persian rug worn thin by use and beating. I pulled the drapes closed and unpacked, which consisted solely of assembling my new toothbrush and propping it upright in a milky glass on the bathroom shelf. I had no toothpaste, but then I had never been convinced toothpaste was anything more than a pleasant-tasting lubricant. An army dentist I had known swore that the mechanical action of the brush's bristles was all that was needed for perfect oral health, and I had chewing gum for freshness, and I still had all my teeth, apart from a top-row molar knocked out many years before by a lucky knuckle in a street fight in Cleveland, Ohio. The clock in my head said it was about 11:20. I sat on the bed for a spell. I had been up early and was moderately tired, but not exhausted, and I had things to do and limited time to do them in, so I waited long enough to let an average person get off to sleep, and then I went out to the corridor again. Devereaux's light was off. There was nothing showing under her door. I crept down the stairs to the lobby. The reception desk was once again unattended. I went out to the street and turned left, toward territory as yet unexplored.